You're listening to a Countout Podcast.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Ballot, the podcast. Conversation begins. I'm your host, Ryan Nightsey, and today we are flying out of Mexico and heading over to Greece. That gave it away because I think there's only other one. Yeah, there's only, I think, one Grecian on here. Grecian. So thank you already for listening to this episode. I'm excited to talk about our going back to the rest of the world region and talking about Andreas Lambrakis. Lambrakis. We're settling on Lambrakis based off of Google pronunciation voice, I guess. And joining me today to talk about Lambrakis is none other than, I'm going to shout it out here at the top. This is the plug. I'm going to shout it out here at the top, the writer of an article from on the Voice of Wrestling website, Andreas Lambrakis and, oh boy, Harolambos Carbolo, nailed it, Carbolozos? Two nearly forgotten stars from the rest of the world, Lion Mark Luke. I butcher the name. Lion Mark Luke joining us on the ballot. Luke, thank you so much for coming on, and I'm sorry for butchering everything.
I'm fine. Thank you so much for having me. We're gonna mention Harolambos Carbozelos quite a bit, so you're getting used to it.
I'll figure out one of these days. I was hoping I would figure it out before I started, but obviously a little late on that one.
Well, there's gonna be a lot of Greek words in here, and neither of us speaks Greek, so I apologize in advance to any of the Greek speakers. We're going to butcher your wonderful language.
Yeah, that is a general blanket. Anytime we talk about the rest of the world, even like Mexico region, I would argue any region, anyone, guests or whatever, we're going to butcher a lot of names here. But we're obviously talking about Andreas Lambrakis here today. Rest of the world region. Obviously, I don't know Greece. Been there twice. Don't know anything about the history of the region. A lot of my discoveries and my enjoyment of doing this show is learning about the history of professional wrestling in the rest of the world regions, region of the Hall of Fame ballot, and learning about all these different people. And so I'm excited to talk to you, Luke, about Lambrakis. Obviously, you wrote an article, Voice of Wrestling. This came out a couple of years ago. Still be linked in the description below. But I'll set you up here. I asked this to everyone up on top regarding the Hall of Fame and the subject of today's episode. But Luke, what is your connection, if anything at all, to Andreas Lambrakis?
Right. So I don't have much of a personal connection. I first heard of Lambrakis, I would say, maybe about 3 years ago, something like that. And, you know, I've always been interested in the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, and particularly interested in finding names from other parts of the world that historically the Hall of Fame has not, in my opinion, given enough representation to. And it's from there that, you know, I started getting interested in a lot of Phil Lyons' research. A lot of what we're going to talk about today is coming straight from him. And, you know, he's really great at covering a lot of the history of wrestling in Europe. And, you know, from there, I got interested in, you know, history of wrestling in Spain with, you know, Jose Torres, Felix Lamban, everyone there, the history of wrestling in France. And that's also what led me to learn more about the history of wrestling in Greece. And if you're going to learn about the history of wrestling in Greece, past just, you know, the big shows that happened in the 1930s with Jim Londos, then you're going to eventually run into the name Andreas Lambrakis. And the more you're going to learn about him, the more you're going to realize just how important he is to growing the scene there and to just how huge he became as a star, as a draw, and just how much the entire wrestling scene in Greece owed to him. And so that's still, again, not a personal connection, but more of just a important interest as just a historical enthusiast.
What drew you to the sort of historical research of professional wrestling, especially in the Europe region? You know, obviously Phil Lyons does a lot of research on Europe, on a lot of the continents as well, I guess, now I think about it, but mostly Europe. But what was, and I assume you're researching a lot more stuff outside of Phil Lyons' research that he has done. And obviously, shout out Phil. All of my research, obviously, is also coming from Phil this episode. Not a lot of research done on Lambrecht's, despite how big of a star he was, which we'll get to, obviously. But what was the sort of like, what drew you to that sort of historical wrestling research?
Hard for me to say. Honestly, I like history. I like learning about things that I've never figured out before. And so as a wrestling fan and as a fan of history, when I started, and just as someone who's curious and likes to find new things, the first time I started hearing about any wrestlers from regions which I was unfamiliar, that really interested me. I think Taurus may have been the first one that really piqued my wrestling interest in, you know, the history of wrestling in mainland Europe. And that's, you know, that led me down a rabbit hole to a lot of people. Lambrakis is one of them, but there are many others. Right now I am actually, life gets in the way, but for the past year plus, I've had in the works an anthology that I'm trying to get done on the history of wrestling in British India, we'll go back to like 1860s and we'll go all the way to the 1930s. And I got a good amount of that written up. It's just a matter of editing it and then finding more on newspapers and more historical sites. There's a lot there that really no one outside of India and present-day Pakistan would probably know about. It's really interesting. So it's more just a broad, interest in history in general and finding these names I think were really important for wrestling that no one really knows about outside of these, areas. And really no one young knows about it, no matter where you are geographically. And I think it'd be a shame if, it just got lost to history.
I love that. That's, I think I saw you like the VOW Discord. I think you've like in the past posted stuff about some like the India wrestlers, like that you researched and that, just like tidbits and stuff that you've discovered. I'm so happy to hear that you're put together some anthology. Cause that's also like, someone like you and someone like Phil and someone like, Ethan Tyler also in the past, these type of people that do the research, that go in and go into a region of the world and do all this historical research and everything. And obviously go into the 1800s, but probably I'm going to guess outside the voting body for 1800s things. But it's that kind of research that when given to like Dave, it's the thing that, like puts people on a ballot. Obviously, Verb Abrams, someone we've had past guests, did a bunch of research on Ted Boy Marino, gave it over to Dave, and Dave was like, yeah, this guy deserves to be on the Hall of Fame ballot. People deserve to read this and obviously think for themselves. And I'm excited to hear you working on an anthology about the Indian and Pakistani region of professional wrestling, because that is, I think, goes to the sort of thing that you're talking about, which is, the Hall of Fame for obvious reasons, one being like a American newsletter of professional wrestling has always been skewed that way. And then it's, the other thing of just research and videotapes and all these sort of things, how does it get to America specifically? But the Hall of Fame is obviously very Eurocentric, very American, very Eurocentric, especially the rest of the world region. I think last year was the first time we ever got I guess Andre. Now that I think about it. Yeah.
I mentioned this in my in the article that you mentioned earlier, but I think up until Spiros got in,
yeah,
I don't think there was ever, I can be correct if I'm wrong, but if I recall correctly, I don't think there was ever a candidate that got voted in for their work in a non-English speaking region that wasn't Japan or Mexico.
Yeah. So they voted in because obviously Andre would have gone in.
There have been people who have gotten auto inducted by Dave, but
yeah. And I think that like as time goes on, obviously with Spiros getting in last year, obviously I think the as time goes on, the research gets compiled and presented well. We can start churning that way of like going outside the Europe sphere and looking into the other sort of international region zones and putting together something like an anthology about India and Pakistani wrestling. It gets me specifically very excited to read and listen to or whatever form. I assume listened to, because I assume that if you put it together and Dave reads it and says, you know, there's a couple people we could pull out of here, and then we might have you back on, Luke, to talk about some of those people. But I digress. We're not talking about India too much, or I don't think at all on this episode. So let's talk about Greece, baby. Let's talk about Andreas Lambrakis. He is a newcomer onto the Hall of Fame ballot for 2026. A very, very, I would argue, like, just top down, like, a great candidate to be on here. There are a lot of great stuff when it comes to him. You know, there's some stuff that's hard to decipher and discuss because, you know, we'll get to that. With lack of information, which is always the sort of issue with this region, I would argue, especially any region with, you know, 60, 70 stuff. But I think what's very important for any Rest of the World region episode is to sort of talk about the historical context of the region itself. Obviously, for Lambrakis, we're talking about the country of Greece. He mainly worked in Greece, obviously worked in other places. He worked in Spain. He worked in Leighton's career, worked in Canada. He worked in a bunch, I think, Mexico, Argentina, as well. A lot of different places. You know, I'll say up top here is that, like, he did well in other places. He never really became, like, a massive star in other places. But in Greece, he became one of the biggest stars in the history of Greece. But it's important to provide that context for how that is possible. What does that look like? What does a big star of the country of Greece look like? And Luke, I'm going to throw it over to you. You know, what can you tell us about the history of Grecian wrestling?
Right. So professional wrestling in Greece was, at least at any kind of significant major level, was virtually non-existent up until really at the earliest, maybe 1928. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the first year where you start to get, you know, significant newspaper coverage of wrestling. And a lot of that in, like, the late 20s and into the early 30s, a lot of that's just due to Jim Londos coming to Greece. You know, he's a big ethnic hero there. And, you know, he has these shows that are drawing. To this day, we don't know exactly, but the newspapers, some of them, you know, report as high as 80,000 fans at the Pan Athletic Stadium. More recent, you know, other shows, you know, we know 30 to 40,000 fans. And he has, I believe he had five of those shows in that stadium that were drawing numbers like that. But outside of Londos at the time, there really wasn't, in like the early 30s, a extremely large scene for Greek wrestling. And it starts to change really in the mid-30s into the late 30s, where you really start to see a scene start to grow. That does not quite start with Lambrakis, although this is also where Lambrakis first debuts. Yeah, he enters the Greek wrestling scene around 1936 or so. Mm-hmm. It's a bit difficult to say just how old he was. I've seen some people say he was born as late as 1920, which would have meant he was only 16 years old at the time.
Yep.
I've seen people claim that he was born in Anatolia in Smyrna in 1920, which would have meant growing up he would have probably been a refugee from Turkish troops coming into that region. But I don't really know for certain. There's just a lot we don't know about his early life and his early career as an absolute fact at the moment. Mm-hmm. What we do know is that around like 1935, 1936, some wrestling starts to gain some headway, and not just with the big Jim Londos shows. In Athens, more and more shows, which are mostly at local theaters, can start to draw, you know, 3,000 fans. Maybe there's some open-air stadium shows that can draw as high as 5,000. And originally, the big name there is, I believe it's Presco Sporos. Presco Sporos? I apologize.
Don't look at me.
Yeah. Yep. But yeah, early on, he is the early top star in Greece. Mm-hmm. And really early on, though, Lambrakis is very quickly getting pushed to the top of the card at the time. He is headlining. He went on tour in Crete in 1937, and then when he returned in Athens, he very quickly started headlining against Sporos for the first time on August 1st, 1937. And so very, very early on, this is, you know, he's about a year, maybe 2 years into his career, he's already at the top of the card.
And that Crete tour, he was also a headliner. So he like left for Crete, headlined in Crete, and then came back a headliner in Greece.
That's right, yeah. So instantly, like, from, you know, we don't know exactly how old he is, but from a young age, he's already being pushed as one of the big up and coming stars. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I should also mention it's also in 1937 that he first faces Karpazelos. He faces him on May 23rd. I should do a brief background on Haralambos Karpazelos because he's also the other really important name that people should know about for Greek wrestling. He was born, I believe, if I remember, I think it was 1913 or 1914. I mentioned it in the article, but anyway, he debuts in the early 30s, and he originally was a football player, a soccer player, and as the story goes, he ended up getting banned from playing for 3 years because he just punched a referee, knocked him out cold because he disagreed with the call. And after that, he figured it wasn't worth it to wait around, and he ended up going into pro wrestling.
And don't we all do that? Don't we all just get mad at referee?
Part of us always wants to do that sometimes. He actually went and did it. So
1915 was his 1915.
Yeah. So these are both two young wrestlers who are very quickly being pushed at the top of the card. Neither of them are the guy yet. They're both very quickly becoming pretty prominent in the scene, and the scene is starting to pretty quickly grow.
Because the scene is still very much like Jim Londos is the big guy. If he's in town and the numbers, the attendance numbers are going to do monstrous numbers, any sort of non-Jim Londos show, top line show, it's going to do fine, but like not anything comparable to Jim Londos.
Exactly. And Londos is not really there that often either. It's only, there are fewer shows than there are in the decade is about how many he did. Mm-hmm. But partially maybe due to the coverage he got or just to wrestling as a whole, just, getting more popular for other reasons, in the late 30s, it really does start to develop into something. You can look at 1938, 1939, you have Lambrakis is already being called one of the top four wrestlers in the country.
That is 2-3 years after debuting, he is already one of the top stars of the country?
Yep.
Crazy. That genuinely crazy.
Yep. And this is not just like the opinion of just looking at results. This is the opinion of multiple different newspapers who mentioned that he's already like at the top.
Yeah. Phil Lyons has a bit in his article, which, his research article, which obviously will also be linked. He writes here, two different newspaper rankings from early 1938 list him as one of the top four stars of Greek pro wrestling. And by late 1939, he was claiming the Greek heavyweight championship. So in short, just a few years into his career, he was already considered one of the premier Greek wrestlers.
Yep, that's completely right. And I should also mention, you mentioned the Greek heavyweight championship. We should have a quick word about world titles in Greece.
Yes, please, because that was a whole thing in France, and we got to talk about what it's like here in Greece.
All right, so Greece, there are different titles. There are ostensibly supposed to be weight class. There's like a lightweight title. There's a middleweight title, which Karpazelos often held. But then there's like the Greek heavyweight title. There's something at some point called the Panhellenic Championship. Overall, the titles aren't really the most important thing. It's really just a plot device to get, the top stars to face each other, really. You can think of it, it's not really revolving around the titles too much.
Sure.
Or at least not from what we can glean from newspapers or from how it was covered. And you also have plenty of instances where people who are, famous for being middleweight champion, wrestling with the people who are holding the heavyweight title. So there's not really a strict weight class division either. So it's just a name. It's just something to be fighting over.
Interesting. But yeah, it's more of the prop than anything else.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm going to go that far because I'm sure at some point maybe the titles have some prestige. It's just it's clearly not what was the most important thing. Most important is just the top stars facing each other.
Okay. Yeah, that's fair. That's fair.
Yeah. So yeah, go ahead.
I was just going to say that, like, that's late 30s turning over into the 40s. It kind of obviously slows down for very obvious world reasons.
Yeah.
So things kind of take a pause up until, mid to late 40s, I would say.
Yeah. 1940 through 1944, there's really no reports on any wrestling. And I would have been shocked if there were any that wasn't just, it would have probably been illegal under occupation to be trying to do that. You probably would have. Yeah, probably would have been risking your life trying to do something like that, just having a wrestling show in time with the Greece. I mean, I should also mention, I think this is important for understanding the contrast of what's going to happen after the Second World War ends, but Greece suffers immensely during World War II. as many as 300,000 or more people are died during due to the effects of World War II, a lot of them due to starvation. The effects of the war there is absolutely awful, worse than actually a surprising number of countries that you would expect might have seen more action. But it was really nasty there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a couple rumors that I've seen from, I think, Harlambos Karpazoulis' son ended up writing a biography. And he does talk about, like, that Karpazoulis tried to promote a couple shows during wartime, and he ended up having to flee and go into hiding because of it. And, you know, I'm not sure how much of that's true or not, but that is what the environment would have been like. So really, there's no chance for wrestling to be doing anything for about a five-year period. It's not until the war ends in 1945 that it starts to get back on track.
Yeah. Sadly, as much as we all like wrestling, there are bigger fish to fry in the country and the world at large there.
Yeah. So, you know, I mention all this because, you know, Greece is reeling from the Second World War after 1945. And in the next year, 1946, there's going to be the Greek Civil War. And that's going to be really nasty as well. And that's going to last up through, I believe, 1949, if I remember my history correctly. And that you would not think in that environment you're going to have a really good place to build a healthy wrestling scene, which it would be a shame because, you know, around 38, 39, the scene was building very nicely. It was building nice not only in big cities like Athens, but we mentioned, you know, there's a tour of Crete. Also, the city of Thessaloniki, which is the second biggest city in Greece, was also beginning to see some bigger shows. Mm-hmm. So it'd be perfectly understandable if wrestling does not come back and, like, if it's not just a pause and they have to start from scratch.
Yeah.
Well, in the summer and fall of 1945, the wrestling scene in Thessaloniki especially just completely explodes. Mm-hmm. And Lambrakis is the big reason for that.
Yeah. I was about to say, I was like, and who's on top? And who's on top during that period?
Yeah. Yeah, it's really just all Lambrakis, especially in that city.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's an argument that, like, because it kind of goes dormant, during World War II, it is Lambrakis that revitalizes Grecian wrestling. Obviously, second major city, there are other people that are doing other stuff in other cities, but, like, he is a guy that in part is revitalizing the scene post-war.
Yeah. And I'd also mention, like, in the first year or so, he's still not quite the top star. Boros is still around, and Boros is still being promoted, but this is 45 is really the year where it becomes very clear who, like, that in the long run, it's going to be Lambrakis who's going to be the big name. Right.
He's also younger, obviously. Like, that's
much younger. Yeah.
That's, you know, the classic thing that we've learned in professional wrestling. The young hot star is going to have a lot of staying power, and it's going to be, it's going to boom some periods, I would argue. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And we get a really strong sign of, you know, things to come. I think it's July 30th that year. Lambrakis faces Harlambos Karpazoulis, and it's promoted as being for the Pan-Hellenic Championship, which I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. And this draws 8,000 fans, which is a very, very big crowd for a non-Londos crowd. It's one of the biggest crowds that would have been in Greece at the time for any non-Londo show. And then just a couple months later, he loses to Boros in front of 12,000 fans. And so, you know, in just a span of a few months, wrestling in Greece is bigger than it's ever been as just a locally promoted event featuring, you know, wrestlers who aren't international stars. And he's not done yet. October 15th, he wrestles against, I believe his name is Metanis, in front of 10,000 fans.
Yeah.
And so, you know, within a span of a few months, he's in front of 8,000, 12,000, 10,000, a total of 30,000 fans. Clearly, he's the major star in Thessaloniki. And already, by the end of that year, there's no one else, not just in Greece, there's no one else in Europe who's doing these numbers. The scene in Spain doesn't quite take off with, Taurus and Lamban until 47 at the earliest, and then into the 50s and 60s. So at this time, Lambrakis is almost certainly the biggest draw in Europe.
And obviously Paris is going to explode at some point soon. But
yeah.
And I think that's insanely cool historical context. Post-war, the first territory that explodes in wrestling is Greece. One of the major contributors to that explosion is Lambrakis.
Yes.
Which I think is insanely cool. Like, again, what I was going to say Gilda Lily. I don't think that phrase is what it means here. I'm just going to, you know, reveal the curtain a little bit. This guy's case, not fully, obviously, but like the biggest, strongest thing of his case is 100% his drawing power. This guy was a massive, massive star in Grecian wrestling. And this is one of those fun tidbits of that. He is the guy that the first region that explodes post-war in Europe is Greece. He is one of, if not the guy that's helping do that. What did we say? 45 years into his career with five-year break or whatever.
Yeah, thereabouts. Yeah.
So pretty significant as well, I would say.
He's just getting started.
He's got another 2 decades left to go.
Yeah, and you know this continues. 1946. He has a trilogy of matches against Arlovas Karpozilos. Two of them are in Athens. Those are smaller shows, I think, like theater shows. But he does have one in Thessaloniki, which apparently was. We don't have attendance numbers for that show, but it was in an open air stadium. It may have been the PAOK Stadium, which was the big one there, which is a soccer. I believe it's a soccer stadium. It's under a different name nowadays. Mm-hmm. But according to newspapers, it was packed. You know, may have been a sold out show. We're not quite sure. But that's another big show. And this is just another issue with going back and looking at these historical shows. There are a lot of big Lombraki shows. And I'll mention some of the numbers that, you know, people have found a little later. But there's a lot of Lombraki shows where we don't have the actual attendance number. And we know that there are shows in big stadiums. And we know they were during periods when wrestling was very hot.
Yeah.
So, you know, any of the actual, you know, confirmed like 8,000 fans, 10,000 fans that were reported, you know, it's a very incomplete count of, you know, exact reported attendance.
Yeah. Just going through a lot of the drawing data that, you know, I was able to scour, it's like, you know, it is, you're looking at 8, 10, 12, 15, 16, 20,000 stuff, but it's like a handful, like maybe it's like 5 or 6 event, you know, attendance figures of a year, maybe. And you're not going to have every single year concurrently. You know, you have a couple that, you know, that Phil is obviously highlighting and other places are highlighting. Like, I did find one number that was super large, like 43,000. I think it was 1960 was that one. That came from like you're giving the face, and I know why you're giving that face.
That's right. I'm just blanking.
Where was it? It was from Tony Richards' Substack. He wrote an article about the Zebra Kid, and he wrote as like George Bolas, the Zebra Kid. He had a line in here, and obviously I do not know how accurate it is. There's no links or anything in here, but he writes a line in here that, you know, when talking about the Zebra Kid, in Athens, he defeated Greek hero Andreas Lambrakis before 43,000 fans in 1960. And just a throwaway sentence is like part of another thing, but it's like, that's the only number I've seen that's like massive. And that's obviously 1960. That's going to be 2 decades or 15 years roughly after where we're currently talking about. But that's like the only number that I saw was big, but also I'm set that secondhand, third hand. I don't know. So take that maybe with a grain of salt.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. And that's a bit of a spoiler. It's, you know, the scene when we get to the '60s, it's going to be bigger than it's ever been. And I think even before that, there's plenty of examples of very important big shows. You know, another one happens, you know, 1948 is another example. I mean, it's just a smaller end, I bring this one up just as an example of what the Greek scene's looking like in the late 40s. At this point, the scene's obviously growing. Mm-hmm. It's especially big in Thessaloniki. In Athens, it's still lagging behind a little bit, but they're starting to every now and then, you know, risk running shows instead of in theaters, but in an open air stadium. The big one there that is often run at is Apostolos Nikolaides Stadium. And, you know, Lombrakis wrestles there against Kasim Aslan, who's a big Turkish star, in front of about 5,000 people. That's August 22nd that year. So that's just a snapshot of, you know, what the scene's looking like in the late 40s. It's, you know, very quickly has expanded from just being a small time thing when Londos isn't around to something that's very not only sustainable on its own, but is doing very well. And that, you know, just about every year there's going to be one or two stadium shows that's going to draw, you know, between 5,000 and 10,000 fans. And if when those shows are happening, it's very often Lombraki sets on the top of the card.
because he at this point in time also he's mainly wrestling in Thessaloniki, if I'm not mistaken. Obviously he's popping over to Athens, like 1947 I think is when he like 1946 1947 is when he's like starting to headline a lot of shows in Athens as well. But like his territory, for lack of a better word, his city is mainly Thessaloniki at this point.
Yeah, especially 45 and 46 is where he's really big. But yeah, but then like, yeah, 47, 48, he's starting to show up in Athens a little bit more maybe. And so, and what's interesting is just around then is when he, you know, it looks like he's, you know, just growing and growing. And then we get another gap in his career. And this one's not due to, it was career in Greece at least. This one's not due to any war. This is the fact that he starts touring internationally. 49 to 54, he is not in Greece at all. He is just about everywhere except Greece. He ends up working with Martin Caradigian in Argentina, right? Titanus in the Ring, or what we would now call Titanus in the Ring.
Yep.
He's in EMLL in Mexico. He's also in Lebanon at some point. So he's wrestling around. And as he's wrestling around, the newspapers are reporting about his exploits while he's doing so on occasion. So he's clearly already a very famous name in Greece. And they're saying stuff like, oh, he's defeating... You know, he's defeating these top stars and he's this huge hero everywhere he goes. And none of that's really true, but it's what the newspapers are reporting. In reality, when he's wrestling in these places, you know, he kind of a name, but he's not really making any huge waves during this tour. But he is finding work pretty consistently.
Yeah, there is one report that Phil highlighted that he wrestled Argentinian star Martin Cardigan. I always fuck up that name. In front of 30,000 fans.
And yeah, no.
Phil's like, yeah, that's 100% exaggerated. But yeah, like he is a massive star. He helps build up the Grecian territory post-war. Obviously, like as you said, Thessaloniki is the city that's kind of like bouncing back a little bit harder than Athens. And then he starts working in Athens a little bit more. And then he goes on this international tour where he doesn't really, it's not that he works everywhere, but he doesn't work everywhere, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's this thing of that he's just coming, you know, the reports home are that he's this big, massive star globally. And maybe that's, you know, also part of like the PR wing to try to make him an even bigger star upon his return. But he's kind of just like working. And I mean, I don't know anything about it. I mean, do you know anything about like the purpose of the tour or anything like that? Is it something to maybe just get better as a wrestler? Do we have any, maybe not even that, maybe do we have any theories on why at this point, you know, more than a decade, I guess, technically, into his career, a couple years into helping Greece bounce back, why does he then decide I'm going to leave? And I don't know if he intended it to be 5-6 years, but, you know, do we have any theories about like why at this point is he deciding I'm going to go tour internationally and just bounce around place to place? Do we have any maybe theories about why he did something like that?
Well, I'd love to hear if you have some, but because this is something that's puzzled me. But if I had to guess, I mean, Greece in 46 to 49 is not really a good place to be economically speaking. So, you know, you probably get good opportunities going to these places if you can get steady paychecks. I don't know what kind of pay he was getting wrestling late 40s, even as the scene's growing. So it's a bit of a mystery to me. It's something I've tried to look into a little bit. I have not really gotten a strong answer one way or another.
I mean, that seems like totally likely. It's like this guy is a star. He obviously is getting money of some kind, you would have to imagine. Like you said, maybe not a whole lot of money, but he's probably getting more money than maybe the average Grecian person at that point in time, one could argue. So maybe it is truly just the thing of like, you know, it hasn't been fun being in Greece for the past couple of years. Maybe it's, you know, I have enough skill, I have enough notoriety that I can, and maybe also at this time, the fact that he's able to work in other places means that maybe he had connects of some sort. You know, maybe he had other wrestlers that were part of that connect, because obviously he did wrestle various like French wrestlers, and I think he wrestled some Argentinians up at this point too, if I recall. So he's like wrestled other people. Maybe he already has connects, and he's like, let me just explore globally, see how everything goes there, just to get out of Greece for a little bit. I don't think that's like completely out of the question either, because yeah, like you said, during the war, it was an extreme struggle, to put it lightly. And then afterwards there was a civil war. So I imagine he's like, you know what? Let's go to like a peaceful area for a little bit.
Yeah. And you know, we're talking about as if he's like not a major name anywhere. That's not always like uniformly the case.
Sure.
When you get into 1955, he returns to Greece, but by the end of the year that year, he's also doing his first major tour of Spain. And this is when wrestling's really kicking off there.
Yeah.
And so he goes on tour there, and he's slated against all the top stars in Spain. He has one event in Monumental against Pedro Bengoechea. And Bengoechea at the time is probably, I would say he may be like the third biggest star in the 50s in Spain. It's hard to say for certain, but he's definitely one of the top names up there. And he beats him, you know, beats him on Montal, and, you know, in autumn that year. And, you know, we don't have attendance for that show, but, you know, that's a bull ring that can fit up to 20,000 people.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not like he's like absolutely nowhere. He's a big name in Spain for a very short time. He absolutely is being treated as, you know, a top foreigner coming in and, you know, getting a big win against a big star.
Yeah, he's also, you know, speaking to also that in the same way of like, you know, he's going out and getting connects. He's also bringing back people like he's wrestling like Germans, Italians, Spanish people. I don't know if it's just a name, but there's a guy, Limbrakis, drew 10,000 fans for a win over King Badu of Cuba, which is very interesting as well. And then has 8,000 fans for a win over German Fritz Bueller. Yeah. So it's, you know, he as far as like, you know, all these sort of things, he's also bringing in international talent and then going into other places like Spain and going to bull ring arenas. And he actually, to a degree, he has made himself an international star to a point of like international wrestlers now want to wrestle him too, which is interesting.
Yeah, maybe. I'm not sure about all the reasons that these people are coming in. If it's, you know, by this time, like by mid-50s, it's probably Harlan Bruce Karpuzielos is probably starting to take over a lot of the promoting. Probably as early as 1952 would be my guess, judging by when he starts to become, you know, being promoted at the top of the cards a lot.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm sure that a lot of this has to do with, you know, a lot of this is his call, but it does say something that, you know, he's being put in these big events against these foreign stars that are increasingly coming in, that weren't coming in, you know, in the 30s or in the mid 40s so much. And he's the one they're often going against. You know, you mentioned the match against King Badu against Fritz Müller. But, you know, he also is against Ali Ahmet, that's 6,000 fans in Thessaloniki. Mm-hmm. And this is all just in 1955. You know, he's, you know, in front of 6,000 and 12,000 and 10,000. And none of that is going to remotely compare to what his biggest match that year. Because he, goes up against Harlan Bruce Karpuzielos. And at this point, you know, he's usually the one winning these matches against him.
Yes.
And they've faced plenty of times in the past already. But, you know, 1955, he's making his big return. You know, this year he makes a big return from the international tour. So he's super, super hot going in. And he's against Karpuzielos, who during his absence has been the top star in Greece while he was gone. Mm-hmm. And so they get a big stadium show on June 29th. And it draws the biggest non-Londos attendance up until that point. And it blows everything else out of the water. They draw 18,000 fans. For that match, they go about 60 minutes, and again, Lombardi ends up winning that match. You know, so you know, massive match between the two top stars, and this is a match that really firmly establishes, you know, Lombardi says he's going to be in Greece to stay for most of the rest of his career, and while he's there, he's going to be the guy. He is the top guy. This is really a bit of passing of the torch from like the top star in Greece in like the first half of the 50s to Lombrakis. Mm-hmm. And I think that gets hammered home even more the next year in 1956, because they do face again, and we don't have attendance for this show, but this is one where Jim Londos was in Greece in 56. And he was there, and he for that match, he was at ringside, and he shook both Karpuzielos' and Lombrakis' hands, and Lombrakis ended up winning that match as well. So, you know, right, you know, around this, you know, sometime around this time or a bit later, you know, the newspapers are already calling Lombrakis like the next Jim Londos. They're, you know, and Londos, that's a bit of an exaggeration, because Londos is just, there are years, probably even decades, where Londos is like the biggest athlete star in all of Greece, not just in wrestling, but just any athletic event ever. But that's the kind of promotion he's getting. That's the kind of praise he's getting from the papers at the time.
There's a photo of that moment of Lombrecki shaking hands with Landos. I assume there's other photos, but that's the one that is published and that we know exists, is the two of them shaking hands before their match. Which also is like part of that PR spin of like, this is the top babyface guy of Greece, Lombrecki's. It's like, we are publishing. It's a great photo too, because it's like literally like Lombrecki's, you know, going over the ropes and going for the handshake. Lando's shaking his hand as well. And then just like in the shadows behind them on the other side of the corner is Karpozolos just like steering at this handshake. Yeah. It is fully like sort of setting this triumvirate scene quite well, I would argue.
Yeah, it's very it's a very dramatic photo. I really wish we knew just like how big that match was in terms of like how many people showed up, because it did seem like it was really heavily reported. It seemed like a pretty big deal.
Yeah,
but you know, it's one of the matches where we don't know for sure. All we know is that it was held in a stadium that could hold a lot of people. More beyond that.
That's what I think I find interesting, and maybe, you know, we'll talk about this a little bit more. Maybe is that, like, you know, when you talk about like a guy, you know, when you talk about like the biggest drawing stars in all of professional wrestling, Jim Landos is obviously a name that comes up, you know, immediately. If you can quote unquote talk ball, it would be a name that comes up immediately. But it's interesting that like Lombrecki's is not really a name that comes up when he is a guy that is doing as well, and you can make an argument for as well, if not better, like in terms of like longevity too. Like it's fascinating that like there is this sort of like, and I don't know why that's the case, that these are always the questions when we go to the rest of the world region. There's like these massive stars that like, it's like, why don't we talk about this guy that much, you know? Because it is like, it is fascinating that like this guy is, we have this, we're talking about this picture, this moment of Jim Landos passing the torch to a degree to both guys, but the picture that we know is published is about Lombrecki's. But it is interesting because it is like, it's passing the torch of like one of the biggest stars in all of professional wrestling to a guy that like we weirdly don't talk about, even though he is also one of the biggest stars in at least Grecian wrestling. You know, there, you can, I don't know what it's like on the whole of Europe, but I would imagine he's up there during these two decades.
Oh yeah, I mean, you could count maybe if you look at like, go back to the 1890s and early 1900s, you could find maybe Magnus Beck Olsen or someone like that. Mm-hmm. And maybe you could find more than, you know, half a dozen people that you'd put ahead of them. But in this era, I mean, it's a couple guys in Spain. That's might be about it. Like, like 1940s to 1970s. That's, you know, Lombon and Taras, maybe. I think that's the only two I would, off the top of my head.
Yeah. You know? And Taras is somebody that, like, I mean, obviously, I came in late looking at the bell and everything, but like, it feels like Taras doesn't really get talked about too much until like he's popping up on the ballot in the Hall of Fame. And people are like, yeah, this guy's a massive draw. This guy should be in the Hall of Fame. He's a bona fide Hall of Fame draw. And we're like, yeah, Lombrecki's same kind of level as this guy, if not a bigger star than Taras, which I find extremely fascinating.
I mean, Taras did, Taras, we know a little bit more about it. His drawing record's a little bit more, I think, fleshed out.
A big part of it.
I'd probably rank him ahead of Lombrecki's, but cautiously, because there's just a lot, like, there's a lot of shows we don't know for sure. These are massive, these guys are massive draws either way.
Yes, we're comparing apples to other apples, I guess.
It's just a little tricky. Yeah, it's hard to say for sure.
And that's fair.
Yeah, I'd also say, like, I think it's really good that, you know, we have a lot of people who have just put in a lot of work finding these, or by a lot of people, there's one person, but a lot, you know, there's a lot of people who are interested in this work. Yeah, a lot of people just want to feel this bound. A lot of people interested more broadly in, like, just learning more about wrestling. And the reason these guys have not, you know, gotten serious consideration until, you know, a few years ago, it's not due to people going, oh, you know, who cares about Spain? Who cares about Greece or anything like that? It's just, we didn't know, you know, these are, you know, countries where, you know, not a lot of English speakers. So we just, they just flies under the radar for a newsletter that is, you know, mainly headquartered in the United States. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really important that people, you know, just go out and try to find the stuff before it gets lost. I think it's easier now than it's ever been, you know, with all these newspapers that keep getting posted online. You just need to know where to look for them. Sometimes you need to pay a subscription, but you know, you can find them. You know, I think there's one it's a newspaper just found for Madrid with where I'm starting to look into a little bit. And that's got a, you know, stock, you know, that often cites, you know, just how big a star, you know, like Felix Lamban is in Madrid. So, you know, that's just one example where you can just really find a lot of sources that weren't really available to people when this Hall of Fame started. And that can really bring a lot of, you know, the next step after that is shows like this, just making sure that all of us know these people's credentials when they see their name. And, you know, so I think that's all, you know, very important. So it's also just a very fun thing to do. You know, I think there's something very fun in just finding something that no one else has looked at for 50 years.
And at the same breath, sort of what you talked about at the top is that this idea of wanting to, you know, you take that the wide scope look, the bird's eye lens look at the Hall of Fame, look at obviously the rest of the world region. You're like, you know, now that there's more and more research getting done on other people and more information is coming out there slowly but surely, it becomes this like bird's eye lens view of like, there isn't a lot. We're talking this region as rest of the world, and it's mainly England. What we need, like, it becomes this like desire and drive of like, we need to like discuss these people, because if we don't discuss them, they are lost to time. This is Lambrakis, to me, from my perspective as a wrestling fan, is a guy that's like weirdly lost to time, and we're halfway through his career, and we're saying he is the next Jim Londos. that is what, not, and by the way, that's not what we're saying. That is what people in 1955 were saying. That's what the handshake was. Again, we're going back to the handshake. That's what it was symbolizing, is the passing of the torch. This guy is the next Jim Londos. And it's weird to me that, like, I mean, I obviously, it's weird to me, and obviously I understand the reasons why, but like, it's weird and always frustrating, always fascinating doing the show, because it's like, this is a massive, massive star that just like feels like he fell, you know, to time. And it's why I think like the Hall of Fame is extremely important, why all the research that everyone does is important, and why discussion about these people are incredibly important, because it is like, yeah, we have massive stars in wrestling history that exist in other countries outside of America, outside of Japan, outside of Mexico, outside of England, that should be discussed, that are arguably bigger than many of those other stars in Mexico and in Japan, in America, in England. And I just, you know, it's always fascinating to have these conversations. But yeah, where were we? We were talking about 1955. Right, we can move on into 56.
Yeah, 56. Talk about, you know, we talked about the guy from Londos at ringside, but the, you know, he's doing other stuff there. He wrestles in front of 10,000 fans against a Argentinian boxer, Abel Sestak, who was a very, very famous boxer in his day. Mm-hmm. That draws 10,000, and then they have a rematch that draws 12,000. That one ends in a double knockout.
Is he a shoot boxer?
Was a shoot boxer, and he went into try his hand at wrestling. Yeah.
So is this a Ali Inoki one? Is that what we're talking about here?
I don't know about that.
Big Show Floyd Mayweather? Is that what we're talking about here?
Not quite sure about that, but. he was a very famous boxer, you know.
But it's not what we're talking about. We're talking about like a real life boxer and a real life professional wrestler getting in the ring for a big, you know, I don't think we have the attention. No, you said 10,000, I think.
10,000, then he drew 10,000, he lost to the boxer, then 12,000 double knockout.
For the rematch.
Yeah.
We're talking about like a two match program of, you know, real life sport versus professional wrestling, which is obviously a gimmick that happened several times throughout the history of wrestling.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And, you know, and those are the big ones, but he's also, you know, on the side drawing, you know, 5,000 in a match against a guy named Dula. He draws 6,000 against a Hofstetter, 6,000 against a Panagos. You know, this is all just in 1956. Mm-hmm. So he's constantly drawing anywhere between 5,000 and 12,000 fans that year. Mm-hmm. You know, and this is, you know, one year after he's drawn 18,000 fans. And so it's already starting to add up. You can already see he's got a lot of shows where he's drawing in between, you know, 5,000 and 20,000 fans. And still, like, the big years are coming. These are not the big years in Greece yet.
Yeah. So we move into 57. It's a little more limited in terms of information. Yeah. That's when he picks up a new rival in a name in Thanasis. That's what I was going to say.
Kappa Fleece.
So yeah, he, which is, you know, picks up another new rival, which is, again, you know, speaks to him as the top babyface of the region. This guy was a, I think he was a Greco-Roman wrestler. Like he was an Olympian too.
Yeah, he was in the Olympics. Yep.
So, you know, he, you know, talking about a Olympic level wrestler, at the 1948 Olympics is where Kapofilifis wrestled. A little bit older, 42 at the time, but, you know, he's a guy that, you know, straight away top star in Greece wrestling. A little bit of like an Aaron Wolf vibe, if you will, I'm imagining, except older. But, you know, he won the first bout. Kapofilifis won the first bout on nail every time. And then no one knows about the second match. And that's basically what we know about 57.
Yeah, and you know, this is important because, you know, this guy does for a short time end up being a pretty big star in wrestling. Mm-hmm. Albeit a little more briefly than some of the others, but you know, he's being put against Lombrakis. So this is, you know, this adds to, I guess, when we talk about historical significance, you know, Lombrakis is adding to these people's careers when they're starting out. And you know, we'll talk about more about that when we get to Spiros Arrigón a bit later.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
58, 59, I feel like are not, you know, 58 is another good year. He Lombrakis tours Australia. You know, he has a match against Kapofilifis, that's 8,000 fans
in the rain.
In the rain, a real Suzuki Okada energy there. Mm-hmm. And then 59 is a little bit of a slower year. Does have a match though, 10,000 fans in a stadium, where mm-hmm. That's the draw with Karbolosios.
Yeah,
nail it. That's a draw match. 10,000 fans in the stadium.
Yeah. And then, you know, 1960 is one of the years where he's on tour. So he's really not in Greece that year. He ends up going in a lot of other places he hasn't been to before. He shows up in Austria. He's in UK for with Dale Martin Promotions. Mm-hmm. And he actually does get put against some more familiar names. You know, he's against Gorgeous George, for instance, in Australia. I think he runs into George Gordienko when he's in the UK, I think.
I would love to watch that Gorgeous George match. If only there was footage of that Gorgeous George Andreas Lombrakis match.
I wouldn't recommend it, but try to watch it.
If I had a time travel machine, I would go back in time to watch him versus Gorgeous George, baby. Anyway.
You can watch Paint Dry instead. It'd be...
we'll talk about that in a moment. Put a little pin in that.
Yeah. Yeah, but that year he's also, you know, he's another guy who's on the belt this year at Tibor. He wrestles him in mm-hmm. UK. Yeah, but you know, he's just that. This is not an extended tour like it was, you know, in the first half of the 50s, where he's just like not in Greece at all for five whole years. This is just just a year where he is just away wrestling a few places. He comes back in 1961. And 61 is actually a really, really important year for not just for him, but for wrestling in Greece in general. Because Athens in that year, tag team wrestling gets really, really big. And Lombrakis really is at the top. And when it comes to tag team wrestling there, he's tagging with multiple other top stars at the time. There's a young guy named Kostas Papalazaru, who is going to be he ends up being the biggest star in Greece, really in like the 1970s, in the first half of the 70s, especially. He's really, really big. I think late 60s as well, if I recall correctly. Like, don't quote me on that. But and he's young in his career, and he's getting paired with, you know, the established top star, and it's very successful for him early on. And they end up in that year getting into a bunch of big feuds against foreign wrestlers who come in, mostly French wrestlers. They have a trilogy against Felix McKay and Ingvar Mortensen. And that draws, you know, 10,000 fans and 8,000 fans and 10,000 fans. And this is Lombrakis teaming mostly with Papalazaru, but also a couple other people at the time. And then he's against Nikolai Zigulinov from Bulgaria and against Abel Sestak, again with Papalazaru. That draws 15,000 fans. They have a rematch, and if I recall correctly, they may have lost that match. I don't remember what the result was, but they ended up winning the next, they end up having a rematch and beating them on the next show. And around this time, I should also say, I neglected to mention a bit earlier, but it's around this time, like really starting in the mid 50s and really getting really into the 60s, but really starting in the 50s, Wrestling in Athens is really starting to catch on. It's no longer just like one stadium show a year. There's starting to be multiple ones on a pretty consistent basis. Mm-hmm. And 1962 is really when it comes to a head. That year, there's not one stadium show at Pustulovsky Nikolaev Stadium. There's not two. There's not five. There's not 10. There are 14 in June.
Well, not just 14. I believe they announced it ahead of time that we were going to do 12 shows in 1962.
Yes, and then they threw in two more for kicks. Yeah.
And then they were like, this has been such a success. We're doing 14, baby.
Yep. And of those 14 shows, Lombrakis was in the main event of seven.
And this is also in a 16,000 seat arena as well. That could
ostensibly at least hold 18,000 if you believe the official attendance.
Sure.
Say if it's really 15 or 18 because it's the newspapers just saying, you know, whatever number they are estimating. But yeah, it's a lot. It's well over 10,000 people are there.
14 stadium shows, 18,000. Lombrakis is in half of the main events.
Yes. Yep. And these shows are being billed as international catch shows, which means it's a lot of foreigners coming in. And so you get a lot of foreign wrestlers versus a few of the big Greek stars. The big feature coming in is a masked man. And if you look on the newspaper, it's a picture of the executioner of Bethune, who's a big masked wrestling star in France. Mm-hmm. It's not the real one. It's a different guy. This guy is a different guy. I think his name's Freddie Robert, if I recall correctly.
Yes, Freddie Robert, possibly Robert. Could be Robert. Probably Robert.
Robert, yeah. Yeah, and he ends up going on a bit of a, he ends up getting a lot of clout coming in, and he headlines against Lombrakis in front of 20,000 fans.
And, which is, I believe the last night is 20,000 fans.
Yeah. So that's the biggest one, that's the biggest attendance we've had so far. That's not a Londo show.
And the reason we know it's Freddie Robert is that 20,000 fans, main event, mask on the line.
Yes, yeah, it is a mask match.
And Lombrakis wins and unmasks, and that's where we find out it's Freddie Robert.
Exactly. Yeah, and I should emphasize he is not actually being advertised as the famous wrestler from France. It's just a masked guy.
That looks similar, and Freddie Robert has played him in the past before, so it's like, yeah, it's almost like copyright. Like, this guy has gone to TNA or WCW, where it's like, well, you know who we're trying to be and who we're trying to do, probably, I imagine.
Yeah. So 62 is the year where really wrestling in Athens, especially, just completely goes off the rails. You know, that was 14 shows just in June. There's another 15 stadium shows from July 26th to September 9th. Uh-huh. And Lombrakis headlines 10 of those.
And so we're talking about stadium shows in the span of 1962. We're talking about 29 shows, and he is headlining 17 of them, of the 29. Pretty good.
Now there's the idea that these are all drawing 10,000 to 15. We know they're not all. Some of them do draw poorly. He does have a match against Karpazilos, and by that point, they've wrestled so often that people are a bit tired of it. Mm-hmm. That one, we don't know what the attendance is. It says, all we know is that it was reported drew poorly. I'm taking that to mean it probably did under, it could have done under 5,000 fans. It's hard to say exactly, but maybe they're saying it drew poorly because everything else was drawing so well. Maybe it drew like 8,000 or something. It's hard to say. So these aren't all 10 to 15,000 fans guaranteed. They may, less than half might be 10,000 fans, but a good amount of them probably are, 10,000 fans or more. I mean, the biggest ones are selling out for sure.
Yeah, if we're saying that like the final night of that first run of tours is 20,000, that's obviously like phenomenally great. I would say I think it's like 10, 12, I would say like 12, 15, if the arena holds, I guess it holds more than 18,000 for saying it's 20,000.
Yeah. I mean, some people say it's 16. You don't know. Like they say 20,000, it might mean 16. It's hard to put an exact number. What we know is that these shows are drawing really well, and we especially know that because if they weren't, I'm not going to add extra shows just for fun, for instance.
But yeah, exactly. Like it's drawing really well. They're purposely adding more shows, presumably to make money, you have to say. Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't they? It's working so well that they're adding extra shows. They do a second run of tours with 15. Now it was 12 and then became 14. Now it's 15 advertised shows. They do those. And then, I'm teeing this all up to try to provide a potential context point with an unknown number, but we're saying that like it's all doing well. Let's say 12, 14, 15, 16,000 people in attendance regularly. And then you have this like bona fide rivals having a match that's like maybe, even if it's like, I mean, I would say like if you're regularly doing like 15,000, let's just say 14,000, I don't know how many every couple of weeks or whatever. And let's say it's like 8,000. Typically 8,000 is pretty good, but I would say that's a poorly drawn show comparatively, right? Like, especially like within the historical context of like, I'm just saying 8,000 on my butt. It could be lower. It could be 5,000. But it's just like in terms of, I would say drawing half the number of people that you usually do, like an 8,000 for a bona fide, these guys were top stars for the past decade or so. These were big rivals, big stars. That could be a contextual point of poorly. And that's, you know, just to provide this sort of, it's like the thing of like, I'm going to pull Eugene Agata. I think if I'm recalling correctly, a guy that is, when you look at the numbers, it's like, yeah, the numbers are pretty good, but this is a dark period of New Japan. It's like, you know, you would contextually, these are poor numbers, even though they're like, nowadays you're like, yeah,
we're two people, people
love these numbers. But yeah, and that's the contextual poor thing I'm going to provide. Like I'm saying all this to say, like, it probably wasn't like 1,000 fans, you know, that would be cancel the show probably. Like, what's the point? Yeah. It was probably like something that was still several thousand to a certain degree.
We're kind of guesstimating, but yeah, that's from context, it seems what I would guess as well. And, you know, and so wrestling is really big around here in Athens. It stays big the next year, 28 stadium shows in 1963. And Lombrakis is headlining more than half of them. When he's not headlining, he's in the semi-main. And he's against all the foreign stars. The Zebra Kid, this George Bola Zebra Kid match, I think is 63.
I don't know, because I also see that in here that there's a George Bola Zebra Kid match in 63. The Tony Richards Substack I pulled was 1960 is what it said. But again, that did not have a link or anything. I do not.
Right.
It could be 1963, could be 1960. I don't know.
I'd be interested in looking into that.
It's the only one I saw that had the biggest number I saw.
Got it.
I'll send you a link. I'll send you a link.
Thank you. He's also in that year. He's against George Gordienko, you know, which is, you know, kind of the feather in the cap for Gordienko. You know, he's also on the ballot. And this is also an important year because he starts to tag with Spears Arian, who just got into the Observer Hall of Fame just during last November, I think, right?
Yep.
Yeah. And so he's really taking Spiros under his wing early on in his career. And so, you know, this adds historical significance because he is, you know, one of the most important early figures for Spiros early on in his career. And Spiros is now in the Hall of Fame. And Spiros, you know, he goes on to become a big star in three different continents. And he contributed a lot of his initial stardom in Greece. He can attribute to this team he has with Lombrakis in 1963. That's really what starts to kickstart him towards the top of the card.
To just put a pin, not put a pin, put a point to that. I saw some stuff that said that Lombrakis trained Arian.
I've seen things about that too.
Do you have any feeling about if it's a training proper, like he trained this guy? Or is it just like trained as in I took him under my wing in a tag team formation and taught him the ropes live in front of 10,000 fans?
I couldn't tell you for sure. What I do know is that, you know, the next year, Lombrakis is on tour in the U.S. in 64, and he's doing a lot of shows, I think, in the South. And he is, again, and he's teaming with a guy called named Arian Lombrakis, and I think we're pretty sure that Spiros Arian pretending to be his... pretending to be his son.
Yeah. Because, not really a fun fact, but if I'm trying to remember the order, when Spiros Arian died, someone in the papers published that it was Andres Lombrakis died.
Yeah, everyone in the U.S. reported that. It was actually the other way around. Lombrakis died.
I knew I fucked it up.
Yeah. Everyone reported in America that it was Spiros who had died, and... You know, it took a little while to clear that up, that Spiros was still very much alive at the time in Greece.
Yeah, it was actually Lambrakis that passed away because of that sort of Lambrakis name change.
Yeah, everyone knew who Spiros was in the U.S. because of the big feud with San Martino, but no one in the U.S. knew who Lambrakis was, so that's not the name that got.
But again, back to the point that I made earlier, is that like this is like a weird guy that fell to the shadows that when he dies, everyone confuses him with this other guy. Yeah. Even though like Lambrakis, for all intents and purposes, a massive star.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, also around this time, and Lambrakis—he's not just helping bring up young Greek wrestlers, or even just facing foreign stars. Around this time, Greek wrestling, you see a little bit more of like the some of these cartoonish characters that come around. There's a you got like a Quasimodo character, mm-hmm. Going around with the Hunchback. You also, in the next year, you also get a blind robot gimmick, which is one of the most bizarre things I've ever heard in my life.
He had a handler to the ring, I believe. Yes. Is the thing. But that's all I know about it, right? It's just all I know is that he had a handler to the ring. Okay, and then it's like, and then what? And then what is he doing?
Well, the bizarre thing is he's not being treated as this comedy act. He's like supposed to be like a real threat, this blind robot guy you can't see.
Yeah, and the Hunchback wrestler, Quasimodo. No, was it Quasimodo the Hunchback wrestler? Or was it just
Hunchback? Yeah, I think it was Quasimodo who came in with the Hunchback.
Yeah, he had a Hunchback. Obviously, I've seen like improv comedians joke on that bit of like a wrestler with a Hunchback so that he can't be pinned. If I remember correctly, Quasimodo had like a undefeated record for a good while too.
He did, yeah.
Which is hilarious. But also like, yeah, I mean, I guess it's a comedy thing, but also like, I don't know, he has an undefeated record, so obviously he's pretty good.
Yeah, he's very much being promoted as like being built up to face Lambrakis.
Yeah.
I think that should say a little bit of credit to Lambrakis there, because he's in there, he's trying to, it's 1965, Lambrakis, sorry, 1963, and he's, has to make it work with these gimmick wrestlers who are getting very over, and they make it work, and they're drawing big with these guys. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, that covers like 63, 64. So around this time, as we've mentioned, like wrestling super huge in Athens, and 65 is actually going to be the last year of Lambrakis' career. His career ends arguably a little bit abruptly, because it doesn't feel like his career is coming to an end anytime soon. 65 is actually his last year as a full-time wrestler. Mm-hmm. And it's actually one of his most interesting years because, sometime in the early 50s, as I said before, up until now, Harlem Carpazil is really the one who's running a lot of these shows. He's the one putting things together and promoting things. 65, Lambrakis breaks away from him and he forms his own group. And you get a promotional war where Carpazil is promoting a bunch of events called the World Catch Festival. Lambrakis' group is doing the International Catch Festival. And so you got these competing groups doing multiple big stadium shows in 65. And here he does face a guy named the Hunchback.
As I say, there is a guy also, I believe, called Hunchback is just his name.
Yeah, and they go to a no contest in front of 15,000 people as part of a trilogy where he loses to him twice before, so he doesn't even beat him.
No. So, and then also in front of 15,000 people.
Yeah. It's bizarre. It's crazy. It works, apparently.
Yeah, it works.
They're practically selling out the stadium for it, so... I can't criticize it that much.
Yeah, it's insane. I mean, look, is Hunchback the Orange Cassidy of his time? Maybe. Who's to say?
It'd be something to see that live, I suppose. A lot of people think it's live.
So he breaks away. He starts his own promotion. How does this sort of promotional war affect Greece as a whole?
Honestly, it in the long run, probably not too much, because Lambrakis ends up retiring right after that year and his group kind of fades with it. There are other other rival promotional groups to Carpazil that show up in 1969, a little bit later. Mm-hmm. But whenever these groups show up, it just increases business even more, because there's just more big stadium shows and they're all doing, and everyone's doing well. It's not like any of these promotions, any of these breakaway groups isn't doing well. They're all doing, if not just okay, just really, really well. So it's, wrestling is just really, really strong in Greece, especially in Athens, pretty much from 1962 through to probably, I think, around the mid-70s or so. There's shows that are drawing, 15,000 to 20,000 fans, even after Lambrakis retires. This is, this is kind of the legacy he's left. He's spearheaded this region from being, a small-time thing that's just getting its footing with, just getting its footing from the momentum of maybe Londos being there, to something that is one of the
that goes dormant for 5 years.
That doesn't exist for 5 years. And then, you know, 20 years later, what do you have? You have one of the hottest wrestling scenes on the planet at the time in terms of just number of fans and big shows.
You have a hunchback wrestler drawing 15K.
Yes. Yeah. And it's and throughout the entire time, who's the top star more often than anyone else? It's the Rockies.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's a big part of the case here as well, is that we're looking at longevity, right? Like, we're looking at, like, obviously he's a headliner a little bit before the war in the 30s. You know, that's, you know, he starts off in Crete as, like, his first headlining tour. But then, like, over the course of two decades, like, he is a massive draw, a massive star, a massive headliner for those two decades. But it's at the same time, leaves a legacy. You know, you're passing the torch of Jim Londos to Lambrakis. Lambrakis almost, like, passes the torch to, like, the entire industry. It's like, here you, I mean, to a certain degree, I guess he breaks up and that his thing kind of fades away. But, you know, he is sort of passing this torch of, like, oh yeah, he helped establish a lot of guys. Spiros Arion, obviously a big person that he helped establish. Like, that is part of all this legacy for him.
Yeah, absolutely. And I lost my train of thought for a second.
That's fine. That's fine. I'll come back to the station at some point. But in, you know, I'm pulling this article, the Phil Lyons thing. I do like this paragraph that he wrote that really sums up a lot of it. As we're about to, like, go into the nitty gritties of it all. But like, you know, Phil writes, in short, Andreas Lambrakis was a major star in Greece, perhaps the second biggest star there after the legendary Jim Londos. He had a 30-year career and was a top star for most of it. He was among the pioneers of Greek pro wrestling. He was among the first wrestlers to start drawing big non-Londos crowds in Greece. He was on top for some of the hottest runs in Athens pro wrestling history and was the top Greek star when wrestling there entered its golden age. Not only that, but he helped elevate several new stars along the way, and paved the way for an entire generation of Greek wrestlers. To me, you read those sentences that Phil put together, and it's just like, how this guy has to be a Hall of Famer, right? Like, that's we'll go into the nitty gritty of, like, what's the case actually look like. But, like, you read these sentences and you're like, yes, how can he not be?
Yeah. When I was, going on the show and just going through all the work that Phil did and everything else I could find just from everywhere, I was trying to really put together, like, because up to that point, I was like, I'm not sure. Is he a Hall of Famer? Is he not? You know, he's obviously very strong. I knew that.
Same.
You know, the more I read it all, put it all together, his case is very hard to deny. I think it's, we'll go into, you know, how strong the region is in general later, but he has a very, very, very strong case, and people should be looking very closely into it and taking it very seriously at the very least. And I should, you know, one other thing that we didn't get a chance to mention, but I'm not sure Lambrakis becomes, like, a big, like, household name in Greece. He's a big name in wrestling circles, and they're obviously promoting him as the next Londos. He's never nearly as famous even in Greece as Londos is, not in the same stratosphere. But, you know, he is famous enough that he gets some cameos and some small parts in three different movies, 1961 to 63. You know, he not big roles, but he's there. I think it's Don't Fall in Love on Saturday. Ori is one of them, and the other one is that something, I think it's called, some weird name. But he's in three different movies around that time.
I like a movie title called That Something. Yeah. It feels almost like a 1940s screwball comedy, That Something. I just like that a lot. Even though it's not the name, but I just enjoy that a lot. But yeah, like, he is. Like, and that's also interesting as well, is that, like, he is obviously a massive star, but, like, for whatever reason, he doesn't, maybe that's part of it, like, why he doesn't have, like, this weird, like, staying power, is that, like, he wasn't seemingly, like, he was, like, outside of the wrestling bubble of Greece, he's not really a big name, but he's in movies, too, so it's, like, this
weird it's hard thing. To say, like, how much, like, I don't know how likely the average Greek person would have been to know his name or not. It's really difficult for me to certain night. I need to ask someone who was alive in Greece at the time. That's the only way I'd be able to tell.
But well,
we know he's not, like, he never becomes internationally famous, though.
No, never outside Greece. Yep. No, he never breaks out, despite having multiple tours, one for 5 years, and then, like, multiple other tours in other territories throughout like the 50s and 60s and stuff, never becomes like international name at all, which is it. But he does wrestle like significant people. It just like he doesn't become like a name. And maybe that's just, maybe that's length he is in a region. I don't know or how he's booked or whatever, but it just doesn't work. And I think that's obviously like a way, a downside to his case is like for whatever reason, it's only Greece. Nowhere else he really works. Does he get over in any real
way? Well, yeah. I mean, he gets some main events in some places. Like I mentioned Spain before, he does get a big boring show there. Sure. It's not like he's a nothing burger anywhere else. He's either mid card to being like put against some top guys on occasion. But yeah, never becomes super famous anywhere else.
That's Carlos
Colon never became super famous outside Puerto Rico. He's in the Hall of Fame. So it's far from a disqualifying factor.
I think that's a great point. Let's talk about the crux of the construction of the case here for Lambrakis. We're looking at the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. The criteria is basically that you need to have be outstanding in two of the three categories that are your working ability, your drawing power, and your historical significance in a positive manner. Or, obviously, if not two of the three, so outstanding in one that it deserves inclusion.
Or just really consistently great in all three would work. Yeah,
and obviously, if you're consistently great in all three, I think a lot of people try to check that box off first. We'll go through the case here and sort of construct it here. We'll start off with an easy one, working ability.
Okay, working ability, it's easy and it's hard because there is exactly one match we have footage of from Rockies. It's against Gorgeous George in Australia when he's on tour in 1960. Gorgeous George is not working hard at all. He's taking a day off. Lambrakis doesn't look very good. You can watch the match yourself. It's boring.
It's so boring. It's also like such a Gorgeous George match. And you can tell that it is like a George constructed match. You know what I'm saying? Like so much of the spots are centered around what George is doing and gimmick and everything.
Yeah.
Lambrakis is just like a guy in the match. And that sucks to see. Like, maybe like a real good wrestling viewer can like pick out certain like, oh, he feeds really well, or like his timing's good, you know, maybe like someone really in the weeds can pick it up on one match of like that. I think it's also like 6 minutes, maybe. It's like something super short.
I don't even think we have full footage of it, which horrifies me that match went on even longer, but
but yeah, exactly. It's like we have one match, at least we have something. I mean, Los Espantos, we did last month, they got nothing in any sort of trios or tag team fashion. The only thing we have is because of a movie with Espanto One. But here it's like we have something, but the downside is that something does not showcase Lambrakis in any capacity.
And you know, to be fair, you know, this is, you know, 1960. He's a bit older at this time. If you look at photos from when he's younger, he seems to be in a bit, you know, he's never in like bad shape, but he seems to be a little bit more fit, a little bit more mobile looking when he's younger. So it's really hard to say. We really don't know if he was any good at a worker at any point. All we know is that he had a bad match in 1960 against Gorgeous George in Australia. That's kind of the limit of what we know about his in-ring ability. I mean, we do have newspapers can be, we can look at the newspapers, see what they were saying. I don't think they say too much about the in-ring ability itself. We know that, like, I think it was in 1955, the newspapers, they have a bunch of people that they poll to vote on, like, best wrestler, and they vote for Haralambos Karpazilos, who at the time is a top star, but I don't know if that they're just voting for the top star or not. So it's really hard to say because we don't have any firsthand accounts. We don't really know what the people at the time were thinking, and the footage we have is negative, if anything. So really there's nothing there to add to his case at all.
I don't even know if the footage is like negative against Lambrakis, because it's like I think it's nothing. It's just like,
yeah, it's if it's negative, it's a very small negative. It's like it's sample size of one in a match where he's not designed to be a top star. So
because it's also like it's not him in Greece too. Like if we had a match of him in Greece, then I think that'd be completely different. It's just this thing of like, I don't even see it as a negative. It to me exists in the same plane if we said there's zero footage of the guy, because it's like I don't know. Like this, I pull nothing from that match, which again, maybe that's saying something, but I also don't know, because we know that he's not like an international star, and and you know, maybe they needed to have the buy-in of Greece to translate over, and maybe in other countries there is no buy-in, and you know, it just doesn't work. You know, that happens. It still happens today. I don't know. Like, maybe he just, you know, he has the Hulk Hogan factor where he's just like a big star, but he can't really wrestle too well. We don't know. The lack of sample size, like you said, is lack of a quantity for that sample size is obviously the big issue here.
Yep.
Go ahead.
No, that's it.
Yeah, that's fair. I don't know how much more we say about working ability. Drawing power. We've already kind of alluded to it a bunch here, but big capital B-I-G star. Andreas Lambrakis here. Any big data points you want to pull out and sort of collate together here?
I mean, I can tell you that if you take all of the shows that he drew at least 5,000 fans, you can count it up. I think it's between 20 and 30. It's about 30 shows, and it totals 300,000 fans or so. And that's a very limited sample size. That's probably like a third of the number of total stadium shows he had. Now, I personally believe newspapers are more likely to report the attendance if it's a good attendance than a bad one. So you can, you know, you can't just multiply it by three, but
sure.
But you know, huge draw, without any doubt whatsoever, one of the biggest draws in the history of Europe. Is he top five all time? Is he not top five, but top 10? Not quite sure. He's definitely not outside the top 10. There's just no way he's outside the top 10. And he could be in the top five.
Yeah. The stats you pull here from your article, headline act at least 36 shows that drew 5,000 or more from 1945 to 1965. 17 of those shows drew at least 10,000. So that is half, I think. A little less than half. And that Phil Lyons found records of over 100 major shows. I assume during that same period, you don't have it here, but I assume during that same period with Lambrakis as the headliner main attraction.
Yeah, exactly. So, and you know, we mentioned this before, there's some shows where we know they were probably big shows because they were promoted as a big deal in the papers, where we just don't have the attendance figures, but we know they happen in these stadiums that could fit 15 to 20,000 fans. So, you know, it's some of the issues we might have with like looking at these stars from Spain with Lamba and Torres. I mentioned Bangoicha a little earlier. That's another one where, you know, we know they're headlining these bull rings. We know we have some photos where they look half full. We have some photos where they look completely full. We know they're often reported as being completely full or mostly full. So we have to kind of guesstimate. But when we do, I think it's impossible to say he's not a top 10 draw in the history of Europe. And he's a pretty strong, he has an argument for being top five.
Yeah, no, I think that's totally fair. How do you see the sort of, because I think longevity also is a big part of things as well. You know, we're talking about not just he's a headliner where you know, he's a big top guy packing 43,000 plus consistently for like a couple of years. We're talking about like he's practically a headliner from the beginning, and he's pulling numbers consistently for about two decades. How do you sort of see him on sort of that longevity feel? How does that sort of add to his case?
Right. Well, if I'm going to compare him to, you know, I think what a lot of people who have been on your show have mentioned when they talk about people they'd vote for in the rest of the world, they always go to Torres, and I very much should go to Torres too. Torres, you know, he starts being a big star in 47 and he remains so until the earliest to mid 60s or so is when he stops headlining quite so regularly. Lambrakis is headlining longer than that, and people are praising Torres's longevity. So I think that gives you an idea of the company he's in when it comes to longevity at the top of the card.
I think that's a perfect way to sum that up because you're right. When you look at the rest of the world, Torres is the number one. Maybe a lot of people would say that Torres is one of the bigger draws of the entire ballot, you know, and we're talking about Lambrakis is in that same conversation. If not, you know, you could, depending on how you feel about longevity of it all, and obviously the lack of data as well for Lambrakis, if not better than Torres, equal footing to Torres.
Yeah, I mean, I'm personally with that Torres might be a bigger draw. It's just so hard to say.
But, sure, yeah. I'm leaning into the we don't know, so it could be better. which is not fair. to be fair.
All we know is for sure is like we can, you know, try to compare them, compare the fine points between them. Both huge draws, and so if one, if you're saying one is comparable to the other, that should be enough to give you an idea.
Exactly. Yeah. Historical significance. I mean, we've kind of also a little bit laid it out. One of the biggest stars in the history of Greek wrestling, up there with Jim Londos. Again, you can. I'm not going to say. I still say the fact that I know who Jim Londos is and Lambrakis, I had to discover. I would say Jim Londos is probably the biggest star of Greece. But you know, in terms of like drawing and all this sort of stuff, you know, you can do the comparisons of longevity, all these sort of things. But the thing I mentioned before is that a 30-year career, top star for most of it, one of the biggest stars, a pioneer, like we said, sort of said, the guy that after World War II brings Greek wrestling back, and to a degree, like European wrestling back, obviously not in terms of like touring, but just sort of like the first big territory to return post-war. The one of the first guys that help grow non-Londos drawing cards in Greece, which I think is also significant. Like his significance is like how big of a star really, and how long he was, and obviously a connection to Spiros Arion, a former, not former, but a guy that just went into the Hall of Fame, a guy that he helped establish stars like a Hall of Famer in Arion.
Yep. When we talk about, you know, when we go over the rest of the world, you know, we've talked about Spiros, George Gordienko is another name that gets talked about as, you know, a guy who was, oh yeah, he's a big star in Greece. You know, these guys are a big star in Greece in like the late 60s after, like, especially after Lambrakis is retired. If you're just looking at the one, if you have to pick one person who lays the groundwork for making that possible, just year after year building the scene, it's Lambrakis, or maybe you can make an argument for Haralambos Karpozilos because he's the one promoting and he's the second biggest star. I would actually strongly advocate for him to be on the ballot as well. You know, it's one of the two you have to pick. And, you know, this is a big, it's a scene that gets really big and stays that way up through like pretty much the mid 70s. And, yeah. You know, and if you're, again, if you're picking one name, you might want to pick Lambrakis for that, to credit to that.
Yeah. I think that's massive. Like to me, when I'm looking at all this information, you know, at minimum, the second biggest draw of Greece, he is extremely historically significant wrestler into the history of Grecian wrestling. He is a guy that dominates the sport for 30 years, basically. And then it starts, you know, not immediately, but, you know, 10 years afterwards things start turning a little bit in the other direction, you know? So it's like, it is like the golden period. He's a star as the golden period's peaking up as well. Like it is like, it is, he is the big star during a massive portion of Greek wrestling history.
Yep, absolutely. So yeah, I mean, I'd say absolutely Hall of Fame level for drawing. There's no doubt about it. Arguably Hall of Fame level historical significance. The only downside you could say historical significance is that, you know, the scene does end in Greece. You can argue that like it doesn't go on maybe as long as you would otherwise like to get like a perfect this is just to say he's not like a top 50 historical significant of all time or anything quite that level, you could argue, but absolutely very, very strong historical significance and absolutely Hall of Fame level drawing, you know, and work. Maybe someone will come along who knows more than we do in the future. But until then, we can't really say anything about that.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, let's move into this final portion here, which is talking about the ballot itself, talking about the rest of the world region itself. I just shared my screen with you, and we'll go over the rest of the world region here as we do with the subject matter. Rest of the world, interesting region here this time around. You have 14 acts, as we know today. Obviously, Dave can always add people later. 14 acts, that means you get 4 votes. Those acts, as it currently stands, Jose Torres, Otto Vons, Billy Joyce, George Gordienko, Dominic DiNucci, Adrian Street, The Royal Brothers, Ted Boy Marito, Gilbert Leduc, Killer Carl Cox, Steve Gray, hanging on by a thread at 10.1. And then the newcomers coming on is Tibor Zakas, Andreas Lambrakis, and Le Petit Prince. If I recall, we also have 3 people on the 1550 for rest of the world here. I'm doing it off the top of my head. I believe it is DiNucci, Cox
and Billy Joyce is
third. Billy Joyce, yes. Yep. Those are the three at the 15 to 50. And I want to say,
didn't realize he was also there.
Who was also there?
I didn't realize Carl Cox was also at 15.
I'm going to double check that because I said that and I was like, I don't feel confident with that, but I'll double check that. But while I'm double checking that, I would love to hear, you know, if you had a vote today, if the ballots were due today, you have these four vote, you have up to four, I should say, you have up to four. Who are you thinking about for voting for the rest of the world region?
All right. Well, this is the category where I don't vote in the Hall of Fame. If I have a lot of sympathy to the people who care about this category and do, because to me, this is without a doubt the strongest region on the bracket, on the entire ballot. It's stronger than historical, modern, or any Japan, Mexico, non-wrestlers. And that's because I think there are probably seven or eight acts here that you can make a decent enough argument for where you might be able to convince me. And, you know, Lombrakis is one of them. So it's very, you know, it's very difficult for me. I need to vote. I would, if I had a vote, I would need to vote for Taras. He'd be pretty much required voting.
Taras, I agree. I'm a voter. I vote for Taras. It is Killer Carl Cox. It's Killer Carl Cox, Danucci, and Billy Joyce are all at the 1550.
Right. And so among who's left, you know, I'm a fan of Gilbert Le Duc. I think his work is just really great. I think he is a bit underrated as a draw too. He's never like the top star anywhere, but he, you know, he's headlining a bunch of shows in Spain or in Barcelona and Madrid. And he, you know, he is pretty big as a foreign star there. And, you know, if you just look at his work is just tremendous at the time. So I'd probably vote for him. Billy Joyce is one I feel like I don't think he's ever going to get there. I just don't feel that there's enough momentum for him. But this is his last year on the ballot unless he gets above 50%. I think he should be in. I think there's been plenty. I think Ethan Tyler's done a good job referencing just how good he was as a worker, how incredible he was, and just what kind of level of high esteem that his peers held him in. Also, you know, it's no small beans that he's the guy who's training Carl Gotch, who then goes on to, you know, do what he does in Japan. So I think Joyce is a guy that should be in. And so since it's last on the ballot, I think that even if he in a vacuum you think he's in, but you don't think he's in your top four, you should strongly consider him anyways. Let's see. And then the fourth person here, let me just take a quick look.
So right now you're thinking about Taras, Joyce, and Le Duc with a fourth open vote.
Yeah, I'd probably, you know, I'd consider Lombrakis, but I think Cordy Yanko is also incredibly strong. You know, by all accounts, just a awesome worker, just a, you know, a real shooter in his day, as a lot of people have said, and had, very, another guy who just, as more and more research of him has come out, people have realized that he, you know, was a big draw just in places that didn't get a lot of attention. You know, Drew Biggin, I think, what was it, New Zealand, South Africa, in Iraq, he had a big match. In Greece, he was a big star as well. So, I mean, right now, those would probably be my four. In a vacuum, I'd like to have a vote for Lombrakis. Danucci's another one who I'm, like, on the line about, and he's on his 15th year, so I imagine a lot of people are going to strongly consider him. You know, really big, obviously really big star in Australia, only for, you know, not even a decade. But, you know, when he was, you know, I think it was Jim Barnett who said Danucci was his biggest babyface draw. So, you know, that's another one. You know, the Royal Brothers, if you go, you know, not big stars or anything, but if you go and watch their work, like, is there a better tag team at that time in like the early 70s? There certainly is a better one in the UK. So that's another one that you'd like to think about. Ted Boy Marino, who I think people have done a lot of great advocacy for. You know, you have a guy who is just this huge TV star who's on all the TV programs. Everyone knows his name for a few, you know, his run's only a few years long, but it's hard to just discount him completely. So I think this category is just chock full of great candidates that you can make strong arguments for. And there's going to be some losers because of that in a vacuum probably should be in.
Yeah. It's a fascinating category to me in so many ways. I fully agree. A tough category to vote for because it is, I think there are a lot of people that deserve to be in the Hall of Fame here. But then you have the three newcomers that are obviously going to eat up some votes. And then you also have the three 1550s that are obviously going to eat up. Well, I'm not going to say obviously. I think you and I can both agree that certainly two people will be eating up a lot of votes. I can't say necessarily the same for Killer Carl Cox, but you never know. But still, like, this idea of, like, you know, we know that 1550s tend to get a push. Like, people are like, okay, this is the last name on the ballot. People tend to do a lot, you know, a lot more people like to do research, be like, okay, let me double down. Let's see new research. Let's see what's found out. So these 1550s tend to vacuum up a good amount of votes. I can't say for certain that, like, you know, who from this region will go in, if anyone goes in next year, because it is, like, so many people I think are really good. You have a good amount of people at the top of the rest of the rural region. You have new people coming in, like Lambrakis, that is, like, to me, like, an undeniable Hall of Fame level draw, that should easily get in this Hall of Fame. But it's like, I agree with you. It's like, does he get a vote? I don't know, because it's like, there are a lot of people that he has to contend with.
And, you know, there's Le Petit Prince too on here.
Yes.
Talk about a guy who's, what, like, are we still at his time yet? Or do we know how many decades ahead of his time he was?
Exactly. A guy that, again, was decades upon decades ahead of his time, you know, and developed a style not based off of, like, Lucha Libre or anything else, but just based off of, like, his own, like, athleticism and circus athletic knowledge, whereas, like, everyone else is, like, inspired by, like, Lucha Libre and all these sort of things, and that's why, like, the rest of the globe, you know Puresu, the sort of, like, the Will Ospreay Lucha-esque, you know, everything's amalgamated to a certain degree, and this is the guy that's, like, so disparate from the rest of the globe, but developed a style that is now what it is today, is insane. That unheard, like, that is insane thing. But again, it's like, this is such an insanely tough category. Four votes sucks. I don't know who to vote for this year, but
I would really like to see, like, six or seven names get added there. Like, I don't know. Like, part of me, this doesn't seem fair, but, like, part of me wants, like, six or seven names that are, like, good, but not quite a Hall of Fame, just to make the decision easier. But that wouldn't be quite fair.
I need a couple Kane and Booker T's in this region. but no, I think it's a fantastic region. I don't disagree really with any of the picks. I mean, who did I vote for? I believe I voted for Gordienko and Tarez as well last year. Mm-hmm. I don't remember how many votes there was last year, but I voted for those two. And I voted for Ted Boy. I'll look it up later. It doesn't matter. But I know I fully agree with those things. And I voted for Ted Boy as well, for sure.
And yeah, in a vacuum, I'd probably go Lambrakis. Maybe if I thought about it more, I'd put him over, like, I don't know. You know what? It's maybe over Leduc. I don't know. It's tough.
It's extremely tough. It's an extremely tough region. So yeah, we'll see what happens. And I remember I was going to say, the fact that it's, like, it's a tough region. You have these three new people coming in that I've all, you know, doing the episodes about Prance and Lambrakis, strong candidates. And then you have the three 1550s. Luke, I can see a reality, and maybe people disagree with me. I could see a reality where Tarez doesn't get in just because of all the down ballot nonsense that's going on. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I have no predictions. Anything could really happen this coming year.
It's a coin flip. Or Tarez needs to get 15 in coin flips, 14 coin flips.
Tarez does need to get in eventually, because there's other stars in Spain who can't be on the ballot until he's in, because there'd be no point. So he needs to get in sooner rather than later. Hopefully it's easier. We'll see.
Yeah, I mean, even then, I think he has plenty of time, because I think this is his fifth year, something like that.
Oh, yeah, he's got time.
So luckily he's got time. We just have to get through.
But the longer he's there, the more votes he's going to eat up without quite getting in.
I totally agree. Well, Luke, it has been an extreme pleasure talking to you. You are extremely knowledgeable. Don't sell yourself short. You were extremely knowledgeable and great audio here. I very much like talking to you and learning so much about Greece wrestling history, Luke. I'm not going to ask you about the plugs, but I am going to point out again, Voices of Wrestling wrote a whole article about Lambrakis and one of his biggest rivals, with names that I can totally say.
Carpus Yolos, yeah.
Thank you. So definitely everyone go check out that article if you want to learn a little bit more about that rivalry. Link will be in the description below. Luke, I can feel myself wanting to say, do you have any other plugs? So I'm going to
point that out. If anyone asks, the answer is no. if everything goes right, you will never figure out where I am online unless I'm actively doing something like this.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time out to step online and talk and come onto the ballot and talk about this. Luke, it's been a pleasure talking to you. You can come back anytime. And I'm genuinely very intrigued, and I hope a lot of other people are intrigued, about that eventual sort of anthology about Indian pro wrestling, Indian and Pakistani pro wrestling. I'm trying to remember. Did you say that in the audio or outside of audio? I think you said it in audio.
I said in audio, I think.
That you're in the like review your stages.
Yeah, there's still more I want to research. There's an old book from it's called Strongmen Over the Years by Muzmadar, I think his name was. He wrote a book in the 1930s on wrestling in the early 1900s. There's three copies that exist in the world. I'm trying to get my hands on one. I really don't feel comfortable doing anything until I find it and just start cross-referencing stuff. But please, for the love of God, bully me on this if I don't have anything out in the next year or so, because I do want to get this out.
I will 100% will. Do we is it I'm not going to pressure you. Do you have any idea where that could land if it does land the next coming year or so?
I have no clue. All I know is that it should get out, because I think there's just a lot of history there that otherwise it's just going to get forgotten. So,
hey, I mean, send it to Dave. Maybe he'll put it in the newsletter. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, who knows? Because there's also going to be people in there that who the heck knows? They could get auto inducted that if you do a write up specific about a person, that that happens all the time too. Well, Luke, it has been an immense pleasure. I won't thank you anymore, but again, thank you for coming on. Thank you, everybody, for listening to this month's episode of The Ballot. A little bit delayed in terms of its release, but because of my doing, so I apologize for that. But if you want more of the show, obviously subscribe to the podcast where you find it. If you have any questions, thoughts, comments, concerns, you can email me or you can give us a phone call. Give us a whole ring on the voicemail line, 9495-BALLOT. That's 949-522-5568. Is the phone number that you can reach us at. Otherwise, you can also, if you don't want to give us a call, give us a ring, you can email me, countoutnetwork@gmail.com is the email address. Thank you, Luke, again for coming on. Thank you, everybody, for listening to this month's episode. Next month, we'll be back talking about an all-new candidate in an all-new region with a guest that I have already a soft yes on, and I have to circle back on an email because he said yes in January. But I have to circle back and if it does work out, Luke, I'll tell you this much. It's a big guest. I think it's a big guest. Right. So stay tuned, folks. But until next month, we'll talk to you all later. Goodbye, everybody.
The Ballot Podcast was recorded and produced by myself, Ryan Knightsey, as part of the Count Out Wrestling Podcast Network. Please rate, subscribe, and most importantly, review the show wherever podcasts are found. If you would like to leave a comment, question, or reaction to an episode, please drop us a line at 9495-BALLOT or 949-522-5568. Otherwise, you can contact us at countoutnetwork@gmail.com. Have a good day, and we'll talk to you next time on The Ballot.
This has been a Count Out Podcast.